This is Chapter Day. I'm Jim Fleming. I'm reading from A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, T-O-W-L-E-S, published by Viking. For more than 30 years, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov has been under house arrest in the Metropole Hotel across from the Kremlin. Now, Sofia, the young woman he thinks of as his daughter, who is an admired young pianist in the Soviet Union, has gone with the Soviet Youth Orchestra to Paris. So it is time for some changes in the Count's life. We start this chapter as he enjoys an American film with his favorite Soviet official, Osip. Chapter 23 of The Final Week of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. With the coming of the Second World War, many eyes in imprisoned Europe turned hopefully or desperately toward the freedom of the Americas. Lisbon became the great embarkation point. But not everybody could get to Lisbon directly, and so a tortuous, roundabout refugee trail sprang up. Paris to Marseille, across the Mediterranean to Iran, then by train or auto or foot, across the rim of Africa to Casablanca in French Morocco. Here the fortunate ones, through money or influence or luck, might obtain exit visas and scurry to Lisbon, and from Lisbon to the New World. But others wait in Casablanca, and wait, and wait, and wait. "I've got to hand it to you, Alexander," whispered Osip. "This was an excellent choice. I'd forgotten how exciting it is." "Shh," said the Count. "It's beginning." Having initiated their studies in 1930 with monthly meetings, over the years the Count and Osip had met with less frequency. In the way of these things, the two men began meeting quarterly, then semi-annually. Then suddenly they weren't meeting at all. Why, you might ask. But does there need to be a reason? Do you still dine with all of the friends with whom you dined 20 years ago? Suffice it to say that the two shared a fondness for each other, and despite their best intentions, life intervened. So, when Osip happened to visit the Boyarsky with a colleague one night in early June, as he was leaving the restaurant, he approached the Count in order to remark that it had been too long. "Yes, it has," agreed the Count. "We should get together for a film." "The sooner the better," said Osip with a smile. And the two men might have left it at that, but as Osip turned to join his colleague at the door, the Count was struck by a notion. "What is an intention when compared to a plan?" he said, catching Osip by the sleeve. "If the sooner the better, then why not next week?" Turning back, Osip considered the Count for a moment. "You know you are absolutely right, Alexander. How about the 19th? "The 19th would be perfect. What shall we watch?" Without hesitation, the Count said, "Casablanca."
"Oh, Casablanca," Osip groaned.
"Isn't Humphrey Bogart your favorite?"
"Well, of course he is, but Casablanca isn't a Humphrey Bogart movie. It's just a love story in which he happens to appear."
"Oh, on the contrary, I suggest to you that Casablanca is the Humphrey Bogart movie."
"You just think that because he wears a white dinner jacket for half the film."
"That is preposterous," the Count replied a little stiffly.
"Well, maybe it's a little preposterous," conceded Osip. "But I don't want to watch Casablanca."
Not to be outmaneuvered by another man's childishness, the Count pouted.
"All right," Osip sighed. "But if you get to pick the film, I get to pick the food."
If the truth be told, having made such a fuss, the Count did not pay his utmost attention to the progress of the movie. Yes, he was watching closely enough when, at minute 38, Sam finds Rick drinking whiskey alone in the saloon. But when the smoke from Rick's cigarette dissolves into a montage of his days in Paris with Ilse, the Count's thoughts dissolved into a Parisian montage of his own. Unlike Rick's, however, the Count's montage did not draw on his memories. It drew instead on his imaginings. It began with Sophia disembarking in the Gare du Nord as steam from the locomotive billowed across the platform. Moments later, she was outside the station with her bags in hand, preparing to board the bus with her fellow musicians. Then she was looking out the window at the sights of the city as they drove to the hotel, where the young musicians would remain until their concert, under the watchful gaze of two members of the conservatory staff, two representatives from Folks, a cultural attaché, and three chaperones in the employ of the KGB. When the movie returned from Paris to Casablanca, so did the Count. Setting aside thoughts of his daughter, he followed the action while noting through the corner of his eye Osip's complete submission to the plights of the principals. But the Count took particular pleasure in his friend's engagement during the final minutes of the film. For with the plane to Lisbon in the air and Major Strasser dead on the ground, when Captain Renault frowned at the bottle of Vichy water, dropped it in a wastebasket, and kicked it across the floor, Osip Glebnikov, the former Red Army colonel and high official of the party, who was sitting on the edge of his seat, poured, frowned, dropped, and kicked. "Good evening, and welcome to the Boyarsky," began the Count in Russian, as the middle-aged couple with blonde hair and blue eyes looked up from their menus. "Do you speak English?" the husband asked in English, though with a decidedly Scandinavian cadence. "Good evening and welcome to the Boyarsky," the Count translated accordingly. "My name is Alexander, and I will be your waiter tonight. But before describing our specials, may I offer you an aperitif?" "Oh, I think we are ready to order," said the husband. "We have just arrived in the hotel after a long day of travel," explained the wife with a weary smile. The Count hesitated. "And where, may I ask, have you been traveling from?" "Oh, Helsinki," said the husband with a hint of impatience. "Well, then, Tevetvola, Moskva," said the Count. "Kitos," replied the wife with a smile. "Given your long journey, I will see to it that you are served a delightful meal without delay. But before I take your order, would you be so kind as to give me your room number?" From the beginning, the Count had determined that he would need to filch a few things from a Norwegian, a Dane, a Swede, or a Finn. On the face of it, this task should not have posed a significant challenge, as Scandinavian visitors were reasonably common at the Metropole. The problem was that the visitor in question was sure to notify the hotel's manager as soon as he discovered that his pocket hadn't been picked, which in turn might lead to the notification of authorities, the official interviewing of hotel staff, perhaps even the searching of rooms and the posting of guards at railway stations. So the pocket-picking would have to take place at the very last minute. In the meantime, the Count could only cross his fingers that a Scandinavian man would be residing in the hotel at the critical juncture. With grim attention, he had watched as a salesman from Stockholm checked out of the hotel on the 13th of June. Then on the 17th, a journalist from Oslo had been recalled by his paper. In no small terms, the Count berated himself for not acting sooner. When, lo and behold, with only 24 hours to spare, a pair of beleaguered Finns came into the Boyarsky and sat right at his table. There remained one small complication. The primary item that the Count hoped to secure was the gentleman's passport. And as most foreigners in Russia carried their passports about on their person, the Count would not be able to pay a visit to the Finn's suite on the following morning when they were touring about the city. He would need to visit the suite tonight, while they were in it. As much as we hate to admit the fact, fate does not take sides. It is fair-minded and generally prefers to maintain some balance between the likelihood of success and failure in all our endeavors. Thus, having put the Count in the challenging position of having to lift a passport at the very last minute, fate offered the Count a small consolation. For at 9:30, when he asked the Finns if they would like to see the dessert cart, they declined on the grounds that they were exhausted and ready for bed. Shortly after midnight, when the Boyarsky was closed and the Count had bid good night to André and Emile, he climbed the stairs to the third floor, went halfway down the hall, took off his shoes, and then, by means of Nina's key, slipped into Suite 322 in his stocking feet. Many years before, under a spell cast by a certain actress, the Count had dwelt for a time among the ranks of the invisible.
So, as he tiptoed into the Finn's bedroom, he called upon Venus to veil him in a mist, just as she had for her son Aeneas when he wandered the streets of Carthage, so that his footfalls would be silent, his heartbeat still, and his presence in the room no more notable than a breath of air. As it was late in June, the Finns had drawn their curtains to block out the glow of the white nights, but a sliver of light remained where the two drapes met. By this narrow illumination the Count approached the foot of the bed and took in the sleeping forms of the travellers. Thanks be to God, they were about 40 years old. 15 years younger, they would not have been asleep. Having stumbled back from a late dinner in the Arbat, at which they had ordered 2 bottles of wine, they would now be in each other's arms. 15 years older, they would be tossing and turning, getting up twice a night to visit the loo. But at 40, they had enough appetite to eat well, enough temperance to drink in moderation, and enough wisdom to celebrate the absence of their children by getting a good night's sleep. Within a matter of minutes, the Count had secured the gentleman's passport and 150 Finnish marks from the bureau, tiptoed through the sitting room, and slipped back into the hallway, which was empty. By this time tomorrow night, he was thinking as he opened his bedroom door, only to discover the bishop sitting at the Grand Duke's desk. Naturally enough, the Count's first instinct at the sight was a feeling of indignation. Not only had this accountant of discrepancies, this stripper of wine labels, entered the Count's quarters without invitation, he had actually rested his elbows on that dimpled surface where once had been written persuasive arguments to statesmen and exquisite counsel to friends. The Count was just opening his mouth to demand an explanation when he saw that a drawer had been opened and that a sheet of paper was in the bishop's hand. The letters, the Count realized, with a feeling of dread. Oh, if it had only been the letters! Carefully written expressions of fondness and fellowship may not have been common between colleagues, but they were hardly suspicious in and of themselves. A man has every right, and some responsibility, to communicate his good feelings to his friends. But it was not one of the recently written letters that the bishop was holding. It was the first of the Baedeker maps, the one on which the Count had drawn the bright red line connecting the Palais Garnier to the American embassy by way of the Avenue Georges V. Then again, perhaps, whether it was a letter or a map mattered not, for when the bishop had turned at the sound of the door, he had witnessed the transition in the Count's expression from indignation to horror, a transition that confirmed a state of guilt even before an accusation had been made. "Head waiter Rostov," said the bishop, as if surprised to see the Count in his own room. "You are a man of many interests. Wine, cuisine, the streets of Paris." "Yes," said the Count, while attempting to compose himself. "I have been reading a bit of Proust lately, and thus have been reacquainting myself with the arrangements of the city's arrondissement." "Of course," said the bishop. Cruelty knows that it has no need of histrionics. It can be as calm and as quiet as it likes. It can sigh or lightly shake its head in disbelief, or offer a sympathetic apology for whatever it must do. It can move slowly, methodically, inevitably. Thus the bishop, having gently laid the map on the dimpled surface of the Grand Duke's desk, now rose from the chair, walked across the room, and slipped past the Count without a word. What went through the mind of the bishop as he descended the 5 flights from the attic to the ground floor? What emotion did he feel? Perhaps it was gloating, having felt belittled by the Count for over 30 years. Perhaps he now felt the pleasure of finally putting this pretentious polymath in his place. Or perhaps it was righteousness. Maybe Comrade Leplivsky was so dedicated to the brotherhood of the proletariat from which he'd sprung that the persistence of this former person in the new Russia galled his sense of justice. Or maybe it was simply the cold satisfaction of the envious. For those who had difficulty in school, or at making friends when they were young,
will forever recognize with a bitter glance those for whom life had seemed to come easy. Gloating, righteousness, satisfaction, who can say? But the emotion the bishop felt upon opening the door to his office was almost certainly that of shock. For the adversary that he had left in the attic just minutes before was now sitting behind the manager's desk with a pistol in his hand. How is this possible? When the bishop left the count's bedroom, the count was frozen in place by a torrent of emotions, by feelings of fury, incredulity, self-recrimination, and fear. Rather than burn the map, like a fool, he'd slipped it in his drawer. 6 months of the most careful planning and painstaking execution overturned by a single misstep. And what was worse, he had put Sophia at risk. What price was she to pay for his carelessness? But if the count was frozen in place, he was frozen for all of 5 seconds. For these perfectly understandable sentiments, which threatened to drain the blood from his heart, were swept aside by resolve. Turning on his heels, the count went to the head of the belfry and listened until the bishop had descended the first 2 flights of stairs. Still in his stocking feet, the count began to follow in the bishop's footsteps. When he got to the 5th floor, he exited the belfry and sped down the hallway. He ran down the main staircase, just as Sophia had at the age of 13. As if he were still enshrouded in a mist, when the count alit from the stairs, he ran down the hall and entered the executive offices without being seen by a soul. But upon reaching the bishop's door, he discovered it was locked. Even as he was taking the Lord's name in vain, the count slapped his hands against his vest with relief, for he still had Nina's passkey in his pocket. Letting himself in, the count relocked the door and crossed to the wall, where the filing cabinets had taken the place of Mr. Halecki's chase. Counting from the portrait of Karl Marx, the count placed his hand in the center of the 2nd panel to the right, gave a push, and popped it open. Taking the inlaid box from its chamber, the count set it on the desk and opened the lid. "Simply marvelous," he said. Then, sitting in the manager's chair, the count removed the 2 pistols, loaded them, and waited. He guessed that he had only a matter of seconds before the door would open, but he used them as best he could to moderate his breathing, lower his heart rate, and calm his nerves, such that by the time the bishop's key turned in the lock, he was as cold as a killer. So unanticipated was the count's presence behind the desk that the bishop had swung the door closed before even noticing that he was there. But if every man has his strengths, one of the bishop's was that he was never more than a step away from petty protocol and an inherent sense of superiority. "Head waiter Rostov," he said almost peevishly, "you have no business being in this office. I insist that you leave immediately." The count raised one of the pistols. "Sit down." "How dare you?" "Sit down," the count repeated more slowly. Well, the bishop would be the first to admit he had no experience with firearms. In fact, he could barely distinguish between a revolver and a semi-automatic. But any fool could see that what the count was holding was an antique, a museum piece, a curiosity. "You leave me no choice but to alert the authorities," he said. Then, stepping forward, he took up the receiver from one of his 2 telephones. The count shifted his aim from the bishop to the portrait of Stalin and shot the former premier between the eyes. Shocked by either the sound or the sacrilege, the bishop jumped back, dropping the receiver with a clatter. The count raised the 2nd pistol and leveled it at the bishop's chest. "Sit down," he said again. This time, the bishop obliged. With the 2nd gun still trained on the bishop's chest, the count now stood. He replaced the telephone receiver in its cradle. He backed around the bishop's chair and locked the office door. Then he returned to his seat behind the desk. The 2 men were quiet as the bishop restored his sense of superiority. "Well, head waiter Rostov, it seems that by threats of violence you have succeeded in keeping me against my will. What do you intend to do now?"
"We're going to wait."
"Wait? For what?" The count didn't answer. After a few moments, one of the telephones began to ring. Instinctively, the bishop reached for it, but the count shook his head. It rang 11 times before it went silent.
"How long do you expect to hold me here?" insisted the bishop. "An hour? Two? Until morning?"
It was a good question. The count looked around the walls of the room for a clock, but couldn't find one. "Give me your watch," he said.
"Excuse me?"
"Oh, you heard me." The bishop removed the watch from his wrist and tossed it on the desk. Generally speaking, the count was not in favor of relieving men of their possessions at gunpoint, but having prided himself on ignoring the second hand for so many years, the time had come for the count to attend to it. According to the bishop's watch, which was probably set 5 minutes fast to ensure that he was never late for work, it was almost 1 a.m. There would still be a few of the hotel's guests returning from late suppers, a few stragglers in the bar, the clearing and setting up of the piazza, the vacuuming of the lobby. But by 2:30, the hotel would be quiet in every corner.
"Make yourself comfortable," said the count.
Then, to pass the time, he began to whistle a bit of Mozart from Così fan tutte. Somewhere in the second movement, he became conscious of the fact that the bishop was smiling dismissively.
"Is there something on your mind?" asked the count.
The left upper corner of the bishop's mouth twitched.
"Your sort," he sneered. "How convinced you have always been of the rightness of your actions, as if God himself was so impressed with your precious manners and delightful way of putting things that he blessed you to do as you pleased. What vanity!"
The bishop let out what must have passed in his household for a laugh.
"Well, you have had your time," he continued. "You have had your chance to dance with your illusions and act with impunity. But your little orchestra has stopped playing. Whatever you say or do now, whatever you think, even if it is 2 or 3 in the morning behind a locked door, will come to light. And when it does, you will be held to account."
The count listened to the bishop with a genuine interest and a touch of surprise. His sort, the Lord's blessing, that he could do as he pleased, while dancing with his illusions? The count had no idea what the bishop was talking about. After all, he had now lived under house arrest in the Metropole Hotel for over half his life. He almost smiled, on the verge of making some quip about the large imaginations of small men, but his expression instead grew sober as he considered the bishop's smug assurance that all would come to light. His gaze shifted to the filing cabinets, of which there were now 5. With the barrel of the pistol still trained on the bishop, the count crossed to the filing cabinets and pulled at the left uppermost drawer. It was locked.
"Where's the key?" "You have no business opening those cabinets. They contain my personal files."
The count went around to the back of the desk and opened the drawers. They were surprisingly empty. Where would a man like the bishop keep the key to his personal files?
Why, on his person, of course.
The count came round the desk and stood over the bishop. "You can give me that key," he said, "or I can take it from you, but there is no third way." When the bishop looked up with an expression of mild indignation, he saw that the count had raised the old pistol in the air with a clear intention of bringing it down across his face. The bishop took a small ring of keys from a pocket and threw it on the desk. Even as they landed in a jangle, the count could see that the bishop had undergone something of a transformation. He had suddenly lost his sense of superiority, as if all along it had been secured by his possession of these keys. Picking up the ring, the count sorted through them until he found the smallest. Then he unlocked all of the bishop's filing cabinets, one by one. In the first 3 cabinets, there was an orderly collection of reports on the hotel's operations. But in the remainder of the cabinets, the files were dedicated to individuals. In addition to files on various guests who had stayed in the hotel over the years, in alphabetical arrangement were files on members of the staff, on Arkady, Vasily, Andrei, and Emil, even Marina. The count had no more than a glance at them to know their purpose. They were a careful accounting of human flaws. One could not exactly call the contents of these files spurious or inaccurate. No doubt all of the aforementioned had been guilty of human frailties at one point or another, but for any one of them, the Count could have compiled a file 50 times larger that catalogued their virtues. When he found his own file, he was pleased to discover that it was among the thickest. The Count looked at his watch, or rather the bishop's. It was 2:30 in the morning, the hour of ghosts. The Count reloaded the first pistol, tucked it through his belt, and then pointed the other at the bishop. "Time to go. There's your property. You carry them." The bishop gathered the files without protest. "Where are we going?" "You'll see soon enough." The Count led the bishop through the empty offices, into an enclosed stairwell, and down two flights below street level. For all his persnickety command of the hotel's minutiae, the bishop had obviously never been in the basement. Coming through the door at the bottom of the stairs, he looked around with a mixture of fear and disgust. "First stop," the Count said, pulling open the heavy steel door that led into the boiler room. "Over there." Taking a handkerchief from his pocket, the Count opened the small door in the furnace. "In they go," he said. Without a word, the bishop fed the flames with his files. "Come on," said the Count. "Next stop." Once outside the boiler room, the Count prodded the bishop down the hall to the Cabinet of Curiosities. "There, on the lower shelf. Get that small red book." The bishop did as he was told and handed the Count the Baedeker for Finland. The Count nodded his head to indicate they were headed farther into the basement. The bishop now looked quite pale, and after a few steps it seemed his knees might buckle beneath him. "A little farther." And then they were at the bright blue door. The Count opened it. "In you go," he said.
"What are you going to do with me?"
"I'm not going to do anything with you."
"When are you coming back?"
"I am never coming back."
"Well, you can't leave me here. It could be weeks before someone finds me."
"You attend the daily meeting of the Boyarsky, Comrade Leplevsky. If you were listening at the last one, you'll recall there is a banquet on Tuesday night in the ballroom. I have no doubt that someone will find you then." At which point the Count closed the door and locked the bishop into the room where pomp bides its time. They should get along just famously, thought the Count. It was 3 in the morning when the Count entered the belfry on the lobby floor. As he climbed, he felt the relief of the narrow escape. Reaching into his pocket, he removed the stolen passport and the finish marks and tucked them in the Baedeker. When he turned the corner on the fourth floor, a shiver ran down his spine, for on the landing just above him was the ghost of the one-eyed cat. From his elevated position, the Cat looked down upon this former person, who was standing there in his stocking feet with pistols in his belt and stolen goods in his hands. It has been said that Admiral Lord Nelson, having been blinded in one eye during the Battle of the Nile in 1798, 3 years later during the Battle of Copenhagen, held his telescope to his dead eye when his commander raised the signal for retreat, thus continuing his attack until the Danish Navy was willing to negotiate a truce. Though the story was a favorite of the Grand Duke's, and often retold to the young Count as an example of courageous perseverance in the face of impossible odds, the Count had always suspected it was a little bit apocryphal. After all, in the midst of armed conflicts, facts are bound to be just as susceptible to injury as ships and men, if not more so. But at the onset of the summer solstice of 1954, the one-eyed cat of the Metropole turned his blind eye upon the Count's ill-gotten gains and, without the slightest expression of disappointment, disappeared down the stairs. The book is A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, T-O-W-L-E-S. It's published by Viking. I'm Jim Fleming. I hope you'll join me again next time for another chapter on Chapter a Day.